A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us something this week. She grew up in Texas, which means she sat through the mandatory year of Texas history. Every kid gets there. Most of it's faded, but one thing stuck. The Kanankawa. And I bet that the one thing everyone remembers about them is the cannibalism. But her actual question is, beyond that one lurid detail, who were these people? What were their lives like? Do they have descendants alive today? What actually happened to them?
The timing is right for this, because right now, in 2026, there's a living Kanankawa community actively fighting for federal recognition. There's new genetic evidence that just dropped in January. There's an archaeological picture emerging that makes the old textbook version look like a cartoon, so we're going to unpack the real story.
The cannibalism is the hook that got everyone's attention. It's also the thing that got them erased. So let's start with who the Kanankawa actually were, before the myth took over.
The Kanankawa weren't a single tribe in the way most people imagine. They were a loose confederation of five bands: the Kapok, the Koko, the Coapite, the Kanankawa proper, and the Copain, spread across about 300 miles of the Texas Gulf Coast, from Galveston Bay down to Corpus Christi Bay. Think of the coastline as their spine, and think of these bands less like separate nations and more like the way a family might have different branches that all gather for certain times of year and then disperse. They shared a language, they shared a culture, they intermarried. But each band had its own territory and its own seasonal rhythm.
The Barrier Islands, Mustang Island, Padre Island, Galveston Island, plus the lagoons and marshes behind them, and the coastal prairies further inland. That's their world. And Hannah specifically mentioned Mustang Island in her message, which is where that new interpretive site just went up. She said she'd been there as a kid and had no idea it was Kanankawa territory.
And this geography is everything. To understand the Kanankawa, you have to start with the water. Their entire culture was built around the Gulf Coast in a way that no other Texas tribe matched. The inland tribes, the Comanche, the Tonkawa, the Lipan Apache, were plains and hill country people. Bison hunters, deer hunters. The Kanankawa were maritime. They lived off the sea. And I mean that literally. Something like 70 to 80% of their diet came from marine and estuarine sources. They weren't just visiting the beach. The beach was their primary food system.
Which is odd, right? When people picture Gulf Coast native life, they might think of shell mittens and some fishing. But the Kanankawa were doing something much more intensive. What does a shell mitten actually tell us, archaeologically?
A shell mitten is essentially a trash heap, but it's a trash heap that preserves incredibly well because the calcium carbonate in the shells neutralizes soil acidity. So you get not just shells, but bone, charcoal, plant remains, sometimes even textiles. At Kanankawa midden sites along the coast, archaeologists have found remains of over 40 different marine species: fish, mollusks, crustaceans, sea turtles, and marine mammals. The sheer diversity tells you this wasn't opportunistic. They weren't just grabbing whatever washed up. They were systematically harvesting across multiple niches: surf zone, estuaries, deep water, and they were doing it in the right seasons for each species. It's a level of ecological knowledge that you only get from millennia of accumulated observation.
These mittens are basically libraries, and the Kanankawa were deep water canoeists, which is the part that really upends the stereotype.
They built dugout canoes, hollowed out from single cypress or pine trunks that were routinely 20 to 30 feet long. These weren't little shore-hugging coracles. Multiple Spanish and French accounts describe them paddling miles offshore, hunting sea turtles, porpoises, and large fish. Cabeza de Vaca, who lived among them for 6 years in the 1520s and 1530s, describes them venturing into the open Gulf in what he considered terrifying conditions. He writes about seeing them take these canoes out through surf that he was certain would swamp them, and they handled it with complete confidence.
That's the thing. Cabeza de Vaca is terrified, and they're just doing their Tuesday.
Because they'd been doing it for thousands of years. They knew the currents, the weather patterns, the behavior of the marine animals. A Spanish nobleman who'd never been in a canoe in his life looks at this and sees reckless savagery. What he was actually seeing was expertise.
Cabeza de Vaca is the name that comes up in every account of these people. He's the source for the cannibalism story, but he's also the source for almost everything else we know about them from that period. Why is he our only real window?
He's our main primary source, and he's a complicated one. He was a Spanish nobleman who shipwrecked on the Texas coast in 1528 as part of the disastrous Narvaez expedition. Out of roughly 400 men who landed in Florida, only 4 made it to the Texas coast alive. Cabeza de Vaca and a handful of survivors were enslaved by the Carrancagua for 6 years. He learned their language, he learned their customs, he worked as a trader and a healer among them. His account, La Relación, published in 1542, is the most detailed ethnographic record we have of pre-contact Carrancagua life. But he's also a man writing for a Spanish audience, trying to justify his own survival and choices. And he was enslaved. He had reasons to emphasize their savagery. If he came home and said, "Actually, my captors were sophisticated and admirable," that doesn't play well at the Spanish court. He had to walk a line between demonstrating his own resilience and Christian virtue, while also making the people he lived among legible as heathens in need of salvation.
We're reading him with the grain and against it. And when you do that, what emerges that he maybe didn't intend to reveal?
But here's what he tells us that's genuinely illuminating. The Carrancagua followed a seasonal round. Summers, they were out on the barrier islands, fishing, gathering turtle eggs, harvesting shellfish. The barrier islands are cooler, there's a breeze, and the marine resources peak in summer. Winters, they moved inland to the coastal prairies, hunting bison and deer, gathering pecans and other plant foods. This mobility wasn't aimless wandering. It was a carefully timed resource management strategy across multiple ecosystems. And here's the detail that I think really underscores the sophistication. Cabeza de Vaca notes that different bands would coordinate these movements so they weren't all hitting the same resource patches at the same time. That's not just seasonal movement, that's resource governance. They had a system for avoiding overharvesting,
which settlers later interpreted as, quote, "wandering savagery." And you can see how that interpretation serves the land grab logic. If they're wanderers, they're not really using the land.
Of course they did. The model of civilization they recognized was fixed settlements and agriculture. A people who moved with the seasons, who didn't plant crops, who dismantled their houses and relocated, that read as primitive. But the Carrancagua didn't need agriculture. The coastal ecosystem was so rich that they could sustain substantial populations through hunting, fishing, and gathering alone. And this is where the European framework just completely failed to understand what it was looking at. Agriculture in that coastal environment would have been less efficient than the seasonal round they already had. They weren't failing to farm. Farming would have been a step down.
That's such a key point. The absence of agriculture wasn't a deficit, it was an optimization. They'd found a better way to live in that specific place. Let's talk about those houses, because I think the material culture is where you really see the sophistication. What did a Carrancagua home actually look like?
Their houses were circular huts, maybe 15 to 20 feet in diameter. The frame was willow, flexible, lightweight, and it was covered with woven mats or animal skins. The whole structure could be dismantled and packed into a canoe in under an hour. That's not improvisation. That's a deliberate design for a mobile maritime life. Think of it like a modern pop-up camper, but made entirely from materials growing within 100 yards of where you're standing. The willow poles could be cut and bit green. The mats were woven from local grasses and reeds. The skins were from animals they'd already hunted. The entire house was a product of its ecosystem, and when they moved, it left almost no trace. Which, by the way, is another reason the archaeological record is thin. They didn't leave permanent foundations for us to find.
The toolkit matched the house. They weren't just fishing with a line and a hope.
They used the bow and arrow, but they also had harpoons, fish traps, and weirs. They were one of the only Gulf Coast groups to regularly hunt large marine animals. Cabeza de Vaca describes them harpooning what were likely porpoises from their canoes. A porpoise is fast, it's smart, it's not easy to kill from a dugout canoe with a hand-thrown harpoon. That takes coordination. Multiple canoes working together, someone steering, someone throwing, someone managing the line. It's a team hunt on open water, and they were doing it routinely.
Physically, the descriptions are striking. Multiple European accounts say they were unusually tall. How tall are we talking?
Cabeza de Vaca and later French accounts describe Kanagawa men frequently over 6 feet tall, which was remarkable to 16th century Europeans who were themselves considerably shorter on average. The average Spanish male of that period was maybe 5'4" or 5". So a Kanagawa man at 6 feet would have towered over them. Long black hair, often braided or tied with deer sinew. Both men and women practiced tattooing, geometric patterns across the face and body, and wore piercings, including in the nose and ears. Clothing was minimal, which also scandalized the Europeans. Typically, a breechcloth or a skirt made of Spanish moss or deerskin. In the coastal heat and humidity, that was practical. The Spanish read it as immodesty.
The Spanish moss's clothing is a nice touch. It's literally growing on the trees all around them. Why wouldn't you use it? It's abundant, it's soft, it breathes. It's actually a better textile for that climate than wool or linen would have been.
And here's something I think is underappreciated. The Kanagawa language is a linguistic isolate. Only about 100 words were ever recorded before it went silent. That means it has no demonstrated relationship to any other known language family. Not Uto, Aztecan, not Athabascan, not Algonquian, nothing. Linguistic isolates typically indicate very deep, very long habitation in a region. We're talking a minimum of 5,000 years of continuous presence on that coast, possibly much longer. For comparison, the Indo-European language family, which includes English, Spanish, Hindi, Russian, spread across half the globe in about 6,000 years. The Kanagawa language stayed in one place for at least that long, developing in total isolation. That's a linguistic time capsule.
That's a staggering depth. The Kanagawa were on that coastline before the pyramids at Giza were built, before the invention of writing anywhere on Earth. And we have 100 words left.
100 words. And that's the context for understanding the cannibalism, which we should address directly and then move on from, because it's consumed the entire public memory of this people. Hannah's question was basically, I remember the cannibalism and nothing else. Why is that the only thing that stuck?
What was it, actually? Let's get the facts on the table.
The practice was ritual cannibalism of enemy warriors after battle. Cabeza de Vaca describes it in La Relación. After a successful fight, the Kanagawa would consume small portions of a defeated enemy's flesh, not as a food source, but as a ritual act. The belief was that you absorbed the enemy's power, or that you prevented his spirit from taking revenge. This is not unique. Ritual cannibalism appears in cultures all over the world. The Aztecs practiced it. Various Pacific Island cultures practiced it. There are well-documented cases of Europeans resorting to cannibalism during sieges and famines. The Crusaders at Ma'ara in 1098, the Jamestown colonists during the Starving Time, the survivors of the wreck of the Meduse in 1816. But the Kanagawa are the ones who got defined by it, and that definition was weaponized. The distinction between ritual cannibalism and survival cannibalism got collapsed. It all just became, they eat people.
There's an interesting question here about Cabeza de Vaca's reliability on this specific point. He's our only source for the ritual cannibalism among the Kanagawa, right? How do we verify it?
We can't directly. There's no second source that independently confirms it. But the practice he describes is consistent with ritual cannibalism documented in other cultures. The small portions, the post-battle context, the spiritual rationale. It doesn't read like the kind of lurid fabrication you'd expect if you were just trying to sensationalize. And notably, Cabeza de Vaca doesn't dwell on it. It's a few sentences in a much longer account. The obsession with it came later from people who excerpted those sentences and built an entire identity around them.
The cannibalism claim isn't false, but its use as the defining fact about these people is a choice, and a political one. Who made that choice?
It was the justification for extermination. When Anglo settlers began moving into Texas in the 1820s and 1830s, the cannibalism narrative was amplified to paint the Kanagawa as subhuman, as a threat that had to be eliminated, not negotiated with. Austin himself wrote about them in these terms. In an 1824 letter, he described the Kanagawa as, and I'm quoting, universally pronounced to be the most degraded, the most barbarous, and the most savage of all the Indian tribes. The cannibalism label made it possible to talk about wiping them out as a public safety measure rather than what it was. You don't negotiate with cannibals. You eliminate them. The framing did the political work.
That's where the story turns. A culture this distinctive doesn't just disappear. It gets erased. And that erasure is a story in itself. Walk me through the layers.
The erasure happened in layers. Layer 1 was the Spanish mission system in the 18th century. The Spanish established missions along the Texas coast. Nuestra Señora del Rosario in 1754. Nuestra Señora del Refugio in 1793, specifically to concentrate the Carancagua into settlements where they could be converted, controlled, and, in the Spanish phrase, reduced to civilized life. The missions were catastrophic. When you concentrate people who have never been exposed to old world diseases into close quarters, the result is epidemic. Smallpox, measles, cholera. The populations collapsed. By 1800, the 5 distinct bands had been reduced to a single remnant group. We don't have exact numbers, but estimates suggest the pre-contact population was somewhere between 5 and 8,000. By 1800, it was probably under 1,000.
Then Texas becomes independent, and it gets worse. How much worse?
After the Texas Revolution in 1836, the Republic of Texas government placed bounties on Carancagua scalps. The official rate was $100 per adult male scalp, $50 per woman or child. Adjusted for inflation, that's roughly $3,000 and $1,500 respectively. The Texas Rangers, who were essentially a state-sanctioned militia, conducted systematic campaigns against them. This wasn't sporadic frontier violence. This was a government policy of extermination with a price list, and it's worth pausing on the psychology of a scalp bounty. It turns every encounter into a transaction. You're not defending your settlement from a threat. You're harvesting a commodity. The bounty system incentivized hunting Carancagua even when there was no immediate conflict.
$100 a scalp. That's the Republic of Texas putting a menu price on genocide. And the Rangers were the enforcement arm.
The last documented mass killing happened in 1858 near the mouth of the Nueces River just outside Corpus Christi. Texas Rangers under Captain William G. Tobin killed 45 Carancagua men, women, and children. Afterward, they displayed the heads on poles in Corpus Christi as a warning. This is not obscure history. It's documented in Texas Ranger records and contemporary newspaper accounts. The Corpus Christi Star reported on it. But it's not what gets taught in that mandatory year of Texas history. The scalp bounties, the heads on poles, that all get stripped out, and what remains is... the Carancagua were cannibals, and then they disappeared.
No, what gets taught is that the Carancagua were cannibals, and then they vanished. The extinction narrative is the final layer of the erasure. By the 1880s, anthropologists were declaring them extinct. The Smithsonian published it. The textbooks repeated it. And that declaration was incredibly convenient, because if a people are extinct, there's no one to return land to, no one to recognize, no one to pay reparations to. The extinction narrative completes the dispossession. It retroactively makes the genocide a natural process rather than a political act.
It was a fiction. Survivors had intermarried with Mexican-American communities along the coast. Others had merged with the Lipan Apache and the Tonkawa, or simply passed as Mexican or Anglo and hid their identity. You don't survive a genocide by advertising who you are. The anthropologists looked around, didn't see anyone wearing breechcloths and living in willow huts, and checked the extinct box. They weren't looking for people who had adapted and survived. They were looking for a museum diorama, and when they didn't find it, they declared the subject extinct.
Which brings us to today. Are there descendants? And how do we know?
The Carancagua Kadla tribe, Kadla means the people in the Carancagua language, is based in Houston and Corpus Christi. They have about 1,500 enrolled members. They've been seeking federal recognition since 2016, and they've been running into a structural problem that's almost perfectly designed to perpetuate the erasure. The problem isn't that they can't prove who they are. The problem is that the proof the government demands is exactly the kind of proof that surviving a genocide makes impossible to produce.
Walk me through the recognition process and why it's designed to fail people like this.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs has 7 criteria for federal recognition. The key one for our purposes is that a tribe must demonstrate continuous existence as a distinct community from historical times to the present. You need documentation, treaties, census records, church registries, government correspondence. You need a paper trail proving you never stopped being a people. But if your ancestors survived a genocide by hiding their identity, by definition, they didn't leave that paper trail. They didn't sign treaties because the Republic of Texas wasn't offering them treaties, it was offering scalp bounties. They didn't appear in census records as Karankawa because identifying yourself as Karankawa in 1870 was a death sentence. The very act of survival required destroying the evidence the BIA demands.
The bureaucratic requirement for documentation is structurally impossible to meet, precisely because the genocide was successful enough to force assimilation. It's a catch. 22 written into federal law. You have to prove continuous existence, but the only way to survive was to hide your existence. The BIA is asking for the paper trail that the perpetrators made sure would never exist.
It's the extinction narrative made procedural. And this is why the genetic study that came out in January 2026 from UT Austin is so significant. Researchers compared DNA from pre-contact Karankawa burials, remains dated between 1000 and 1500 CE, found in coastal Texas archaeological sites, with living individuals who identify as Karankawa descendants. They found statistically significant haplogroup matches. The genetic continuity is there. The people who say they are Karankawa actually are. And DNA doesn't care whether your great-great-grandmother listed her race as Mexican on the census. It preserves what the paper trail was designed to erase.
That's a genuine breakthrough. DNA doesn't care about the paper trail. It preserves what the bureaucracy tried to erase. And this isn't just academic. This is evidence submitted in a legal process.
The Karankawa Kadla are using this as evidence in their recognition petition. There's also been movement on the cultural front. In 2025, the Texas Historical Commission added a Karankawa interpretive site at Mustang Island State Park, the very barrier island Hannah mentioned. For the first time, the official state narrative is acknowledging that these people existed, that they built something sophisticated, and that their story didn't end in 1858. It's a small thing, an interpretive sign, a trail, some educational material, but it's the state of Texas saying something it refused to say for 167 years.
I want to pause on the genetic study for a moment, because I think it's worth understanding what it actually found and what it means. What were they comparing exactly?
The study looked at mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down through the maternal line, and Y chromosome markers from the paternal line. Pre-contact burials from Karankawa sites showed specific haplogroups that are relatively rare in North America. When they tested living individuals who claim Karankawa descent through oral family history, they found those same rare haplogroups at frequencies far above what you'd expect from random chance. It's not a perfect one-to-one match for every individual. Centuries of intermarriage make that impossible. But the statistical signal is clear. These are the descendants of the people buried on that coast 1,000 years ago. The study also found something interesting. The genetic diversity within the pre-contact samples was higher than expected, which supports the idea that the five bands were a confederation of related but distinct groups, not a single homogeneous tribe.
What does that mean for the BIA review? Where does the petition stand right now?
The BIA is slow. The Karankawa Kadla filed their initial petition in 2016. The genetic evidence was submitted as supplemental material earlier this year. The expectation among advocates is that a decision could come in late 2026 or early 2027. If they're recognized, it would be a landmark, not just for the Karankawa, but for other tribes that were declared extinct by 19th century anthropologists and are now fighting to prove otherwise. There are dozens of groups in similar situations. The Muwekma Ohlone in California, the Nanticoke in Delaware, the Duwamish in Washington. A recognition for the Karankawa Kadla would blow a hole in the extinction narrative as a legal doctrine.
There's a broader pattern here. The extinction narrative isn't unique to the Karankawa. It's a recurring feature of how colonial powers and then nation states dealt with indigenous peoples who didn't fit the model of what a tribe was supposed to look like. Nomadic people, maritime people, people who didn't have fixed villages and agricultural fields. They were particularly vulnerable to being declared gone. Why is that specific type of people so vulnerable to this?
Because the European legal framework for land ownership was built on the idea of improvement. John Locke articulated this explicitly in the 17th century. If you don't mix your labor with the land, if you don't plow it or fence it or build permanent structures on it, you don't own it. It's terra nullius, empty land, free for the taking. Mobile people, by definition, don't leave those permanent improvements, so their land looks empty to European eyes. The Karankawa are a textbook case because they hit every vulnerability. They were mobile, so they didn't leave permanent structures that settlers recognized as settlements. They didn't practice agriculture, so they didn't leave field systems. Their language was an isolate with no written form, so it died with the last speakers before anyone recorded more than 100 words. And they were targeted for extermination by a government that then wrote the history books. It's a clean sweep of erasure. Every possible type of evidence that could have proved their continuous existence was systematically destroyed or never created in the first place.
Let's go back to the cannibalism for a moment, because I think we've set it aside. But there's a question worth asking. Why does this one fact survive when everything else is forgotten? Hannah remembered the cannibalism, and nothing else. Why does that happen?
It survives because it was useful. The cannibalism narrative served a function for every group that repeated it. For the Spanish, it justified the mission system. These people needed to be saved from their own savagery. For the Anglo settlers, it justified removal and extermination. For the early anthropologists, it justified the extinction narrative. They were too primitive to survive contact with civilization. And for the Texas history textbooks, it's a lurid detail that makes the story memorable while conveniently skipping over the uncomfortable parts about scalp bounties and heads on poles. It's the perfect piece of propaganda because it's shocking enough to stick in a seventh grader's memory forever, and it implicitly justifies everything that happened afterward. You don't have to teach kids about genocide if you've already taught them that the victims were cannibals.
It's the sensationalism that enables the erasure. The cannibalism becomes the whole story, and the whole story becomes a justification for what happened to them. The public memory does the work of the genocide retroactively. Every time someone says the Karankawa were cannibals and then they died out, they're recapitulating the logic that was used to justify the scalp bounties in 1836.
You see this pattern elsewhere. When a people are targeted for elimination, the first step is always dehumanization. The cannibalism label was the Karankawa's dehumanization. For other groups, it was different labels: savage, primitive, bloodthirsty, inhuman. But the function is the same. If they're monsters, then what happened to them wasn't a crime. It was a necessity. It wasn't genocide. It was pest control. The language does the moral work of making extermination feel like hygiene.
What do we do with this story? How do we think about a people who were declared extinct but are still here? What's the responsible way to hold this history?
I think the first thing is to recognize that the extinction narrative is not a neutral historical conclusion. It's a political act with ongoing consequences. Every time a textbook says the Karankawa are extinct, it's reinforcing the idea that there's no one to recognize and nothing to redress. And that idea has material effects. It's currently being used to slow down the Karankawa Kadla's recognition petition. The BIA skepticism is rooted in a century and a half of official declarations that these people don't exist. Changing that institutional memory is slow, grinding work.
The second thing is to read the primary sources with clear eyes. Cabeza de Vaca's La Relación is the foundational text for understanding the Karankawa. It's where the cannibalism story comes from. But it's also a richly detailed account of their daily life, their social structure, their technology, their relationship to the environment. If you read it critically, understanding who wrote it, for whom, and why, you get a much fuller picture than the textbooks give you. You see the seasonal round, the canoe technology, the healing practices, the kinship structures. The cannibalism is maybe 3 sentences in a 100-page account. The rest is a portrait of a functioning, sophisticated society.
The third thing, practically, is that there are ways to support the Karankawa Kadla's recognition efforts right now. We'll link to their petition in the show notes. If you're in Texas, the Mustang Island Interpretive Site is worth visiting. It's a small step, but it's the state finally acknowledging what it spent a century and a half denying. And if you teach Texas history, or if you're a parent whose kid is going through that mandatory year, ask what the textbook says about the Karankawa, and whether it mentions the descendants who are still here. That question alone, are they actually extinct, can open up a conversation that the textbook is designed to foreclose.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the language isolate. Only 100 recorded words. That's the entire surviving corpus of a language that was spoken on that coast for at least 5,000 years. 100 words. You could fit them on an index card. What are some of those words?
We know the word for water, that survived. We know the word for dog, which was apparently something like kiss or keys in the phonetic renderings we have. We know a few kinship terms, a few animal names. And among those 100 words, we know the word for people, Kadla. That's the word the modern tribe chose for their name. They're not calling themselves the Karankawa tribe of Texas. They're calling themselves the Karankawa Kadla. That choice is deliberate. It's a statement that they were never just a cannibal tribe. They were a people with a full culture, a full language, a full humanity, and that humanity survived even if the language didn't. Choosing Kadla as your name is an act of reclamation. It says, "We are not what you called us. We are what we called ourselves."
There's something resonant about a people whose language was reduced to 100 words, choosing the word for people as their banner. It's a refusal of the extinction narrative in a single word. You tried to erase us, and we're still here, and we're still the people.
It connects to the broader question Hannah was really asking. She remembered one lurid detail from her Texas history class. She asked, beyond that, who were they? The answer is that they were a maritime people with a sophisticated seasonal economy, deep-water canoeists, builders of portable homes, practitioners of body art, speakers of a language so old it has no known relatives. They survived Spanish missions and Anglo-extermination campaigns. They hid, they married out, they passed, they endured. And now their descendants are using DNA evidence to force the federal government to admit they exist. That's not an extinction story, that's a survival story.
The Karankawa story isn't over. In fact, the next chapter might be the most important one yet. If the Karankawa Kadla gain federal recognition, it sets a precedent. There are other tribes in similar positions, declared extinct, fighting to prove otherwise. The DNA evidence that worked for the Karankawa could work for them too. The BIA decision, expected in late 2026 or early 2027, could open a door that's been bolted shut since the 19th century.
It's worth watching because federal recognition isn't just symbolic. It unlocks access to health care through Indian health services, housing assistance, educational grants, and the ability to protect sacred sites and repatriate remains under NAGPRA. It's the difference between being a historical footnote and being a living political entity with rights. The Karankawa Kadla could, for the first time since 1858, have a seat at the table.
For anyone listening who wants to go deeper, Cabeza de Vaca's La Relación is available in English translation. It's a short read and it's gripping. Shipwreck, enslavement, survival, a years-long walk across the continent from the Texas coast all the way to the Pacific. He and the other three survivors were the first Europeans to cross North America on foot. It's also the primary source for everything we know about 16th century Karankawa life. Read it with the skepticism it deserves, but read it.
If you want to understand the broader pattern of how colonial and nation-state frameworks erase mobile peoples, we touched on similar dynamics with the Bedouin in a previous discussion about tribes versus borders. Different continent, different people, but the same structural problem. If you don't fit the sedentary agricultural model, the state doesn't know what to do with you except erase you. The Bedouin in the Negev, the Sami in Scandinavia, the Karankawa on the Texas coast, the logic is consistent across centuries and continents.
The fragility of historical memory is the thread running through all of this. 100 words of a language. One lurid detail remembered from a middle school class, a paper trail that was never allowed to exist. And against all of that, DNA in ancient bones and oral histories passed down in families who learned to hide who they were. The story survives because the people survived. The recognition is just catching up.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Tang Dynasty, a mid-level bureaucrat's salary was measured in don of rice, one don being roughly 60 liters. A county magistrate earned about 100 dan per year, which works out to approximately 6,000 liters of rice annually. Converted at early Renaissance Venetian grain prices, that magistrate's salary would have purchased roughly 12 kilograms of Solomon Islands black-lipped pearl shell, which was the primary currency of the Kwayo people at the time. This means a Tang Dynasty county magistrate and a Kwayo shell money trader were, in purely economic terms, operating on roughly the same scale of annual value, despite being separated by 8,000 kilometers and 400 years.
I have no idea what to do with that information.
12 kilograms of pearl shell. That feels like a lot. How many individual shells is that?
I'm not going down this road with you.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Hannah for the question that sent us down this path. If you want more episodes like this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It actually helps. We're at myweirdprompts.com and on Spotify. I'm Korn. I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.